Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Ivory Coast's government resigned Wednesday in a move that President Alassane Ouattara said would bring more efficiency to the West African state just 2 months after he was elected. This is Prime Minister Daniel Kablai Khan. As we hear here, he is presenting his resignation and that of his government. It was to have been the first cabinet meeting of the year in a move that observers said was expected. A new cabinet is to be put in place in the coming days, targeting greater cohesion and more efficiency of government action, according to President Ouattara. The UN mission in the Central African Republic says it's investigating new allegations of sexual exploitation and abuse by UN peacekeepers and international forces in the country's capital. In Bangui, the head of the mission said he was determined to track down and punish the alleged culprits. He says, I am deeply shocked and deplore it, but our concerns go beyond people's reactions. We will take extremely aggressive measures, firstly to investigate these new cases and to take action against all of those who are involved in these horrible acts. We will also show our compassion to the victims. It's not clear how many peacekeepers were involved in the alleged abuse or what countries they're from. The International Monetary Fund chief Christine Lagarde told Nigerian lawmakers Wednesday that the fund does not support foreign exchange restrictions and that any such measures should be temporary. She made the comments in an address to senior Nigerian parliamentarians during a four-day visit to the nation. She has introduced foreign exchange curbs and allowed only limited devaluation after prices for the oil exports collapsed. VOA News. North Korea announced Wednesday that it successfully conducted a thermonuclear hydrogen bomb test Wednesday, defying again UN resolutions banning the country's nuclear weapons program. Meanwhile, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says if confirmed, North Korea's hydrogen bomb test would be in clear violation of UN Security Council resolutions. The IAEA Director General Yukio Amano issued a statement.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea announced today it had carried out a hydrogen bomb test. The DPRK's nuclear test, if confirmed, is in clear violation of UN Security Council resolutions and is deeply regrettable.
Amano went on to say that the IAEA remains ready to contribute to the peaceful resolution of the nuclear issue by resuming its nuclear verification activities in the North once a political agreement is reached among countries concerned. Germany says nearly 1.1 million people registered as migrants within its borders last year. In numbers released Wednesday, Germany said 428,468 migrants were part of the flood of people exiting Syria. Syrians were by far the largest single group of nationals among the migrants coming into Germany. Germany also says it will not be accepting as many refugees into the country as it did last year. Thomas de Maizière is the German Interior Minister. He says the fact that we have the highest number of refugees in the world since World War II will have an effect on Germany. We think that the number of refugees and asylum seekers that came to Germany is too high, but we're working to prevent such numbers for 2016. The French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo marked the first anniversary of the deadly shooting attack at its Paris offices with a cover that is characteristically provocative. Wednesday's issue of the magazine depicts a cartoon image of God carrying a Kalashnikov rifle with the caption that reads, 1 year on, the killer is still at large. 8 Charlie Hebdo staffers were among a dozen people gunned down at the magazine's offices on January 7th last year in a three-day series of attacks that ended up taking a total of 17 lives. Several U.S. airlines are raising base round-trip fares on domestic flights by $6. It's the first large-scale increase since June. J.P. Morgan Chase analysts say that Delta Airlines began boosting prices on Monday and was quickly matched by Southwest Airlines. Both airlines confirmed the report. More at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
UN peacekeepers in the Central African Republic are facing new allegations of sexual abuse. The accusations include the rape of four minors in the capital Bangui, media reports. Such allegations have been a recurring problem for the UN mission in the Central African Republic.
That's Katerina Hoya reporting. Details coming up.
Also, one oil tank is reported destroyed and at least five others on fire in Libya's exporting port of Sidra. And in Somalia, two suspects are reported in custody for last month's murder of a state media journalist.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Tanzania, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, one oil tank is reported destroyed and at least five others on fire in Libya's exporting port of Sidra that follows 3 days of attacks by forces loyal to the Islamic State. One source describes the situation in the Sidra oil fields as catastrophic. At least seven were killed and 25 wounded in fighting Monday after two car bombs were detonated near a checkpoint. No updated casualty figures are available at this time. Reports say the petroleum facilities guards have regained control and expelled Islamic State attackers, killing several of them. The reports say the local Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Masri was among them.
In Somalia, two suspects are reported in custody for last month's murder of state media journalist Hindia Haji Mohamed. She died from injuries after a bomb was placed inside her car on December 3rd in Mogadishu. The suspects were shown on national TV at the National Security and Intelligence Headquarters. Authorities say they have several identities, but they are commonly known as Mowali Mohammed and Sheikh Awis. National TV says the two have confessed to the killing, but have not yet appeared in court.
UN peacekeepers in the Central African Republic are facing new allegations of sexual abuse. The accusations include the rape of four young girls in the capital, Bangui. As Katerina Hoya reports, such allegations are a recurring problem for the UN mission in the Central African Republic.
UN peacekeepers and international troops in the Central African Republic are again being accused of sexual abuse and misconduct. In the latest case, troops are accused of raping, sexually exploiting and engaging in transactional sex with four young girls, some of them living in a camp for displaced people in the capital Bangui, according to media reports. The victims, all minors, have received medical treatment and are in the care of UNICEF and NGOs. The head of the UN peacekeeping mission, Parve Onanga Anyanga, said at a news conference Wednesday there would be zero tolerance and no complacency for perpetrators.
Les allégations semblent indiquer que les forces impliquées ne sont pas que les forces de la MINUSCA et
the allegations concern UN forces, but also other international troops, he said. He added an investigation is underway in cooperation with UN partners in the car to determine who is implicated and to end what he called horrendous acts. He said that the countries whose soldiers were implicated in a new case have been informed, though he declined to identify the countries. Under UN rules, it is up to the troop-contributing country to investigate and prosecute soldiers accused of misconduct while serving in a UN mission.
C'est cela. Le commandant de la force et le commissaire de police sont à pied d'œuvre.
He says the force commander and the police officer are working together to develop mechanisms to better control international troops. The latest allegations bring the number of sexual abuse cases involving UN peacekeepers and international troops in the Central African Republic to 26. Last year, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon fired the head of the 12,000-member MINUSCA force over the mounting number of cases. An independent panel last month described the UN's delayed reaction as a gross institutional failure to respond to the allegations in a meaningful way. Katerina Heyer for VOA News, Bangui.
In Central African Republic, with two-thirds of the vote counted in the first round of the presidential election, two candidates are head-to-head. Anicet Dolo-Gwadi and Faustin Touadera Both former prime ministers under ousted President François Bozizé are likely to go to a second round. Nearly 2 million voters registered for the election that many hope will end years of sectarian violence. Partial results from last Sunday's national elections reveal a high voter turnout. Election officials say with ballots from about 53% of the polling stations counted, voter participation was at about 72%. The partial results yesterday showed two former prime ministers virtually neck and neck.
Burundi's ambassador to Uganda says his government has not withdrawn from regional peace talks with Burundi opposition leaders. Ambassador Jean Bosco Barrage says his government only asked for more time to prepare for the mediation process being led by Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. The talks were scheduled to begin today in Arusha, Tanzania, but were postponed indefinitely when Burundi officials said they would not attend the session. A spokesman for Burundi's foreign ministry has said yesterday that the Burundi government would not participate in the talks if opposition delegations include those who support violence. Several delegations of opposition figures, many in exile and in the diaspora, were prepared to begin mediation today. Violence erupted last May when President Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term. About 400 people have died since then, and many thousands have been displaced. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 12 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Islamic State militants' attacks on Libyan oil fields have set many oil storage tanks ablaze in Sidra. In Somalia, two suspects are reported in custody for last month's murder of a state media journalist. And UN peacekeepers in the Central African Republic are facing new allegations of sexual abuse. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
President Barack Obama has proclaimed January as National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month. Today, top U.S. officials renewed pledges to combat trafficking through interagency efforts and public-private partnerships. Secretary of State John Kerry calls human trafficking a multi-billion dollar criminal enterprise. He says solving this problem is both a moral obligation and national security issue. Kerry says more than 20 million people are enslaved, but only 1% are identified. While African experts with the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington say while Western governments are transfixed on events in Iraq and Syria, it is important they do not forget Africa. For example, they say Boko Haram has become the world's deadliest terrorist organization, and Libya is increasingly becoming a base of operations for the Islamic State. John Campbell is a Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He spoke with me about several African issues he outlined to watch in 2016. The first concerns presidents who want to retain their power and not step down.
We're already seeing instability in Burundi over that president's attempt just to hang on to power. We're likely to see it in Congo Brazzaville. And in Rwanda, Paul Kagame has already taken the necessary legal steps to seek a third term. And then there's the question of Congo-Kinshasa and what President Kabila will do. My own view is that term limits are healthy for African democracy. It promotes an open political process, and that efforts to extend presidential terms in office do not help democracy.
How do you think these presidents will be stopped in doing this?
It's difficult to do because they command political machines. They are fonts of patronage. Very often, opposition is weak and not particularly well organized. So it's very hard to do. And they tend to be remarkably successful, but not always. President Obasanjo in Nigeria in 2005-2006 appeared to be moving towards the removal of term limits, and he was stopped essentially by a sort of gathering together of all the political elements of the country. But that's fairly unusual.
Okay, I'd like to move on to another area to watch for in 2016 in Africa, and that being the 2.5 million people who are displaced in the Lake Chad region just alone. So where do you see these people migrating to?
That, in a sense, is an absolutely crucial question. Where most of them are going now is not terribly far away from where they normally live. And the vast majority of them are taken in by kith and kin. It's the sort of African support network at its very best. However, it has costs. For example, there's plenty of anecdotal evidence of host families using their seed corn to feed displaced persons that arrive on their doorstep. Over time, I would suspect that these migrants will start to move further afield, really to three places: towards the more prosperous parts of their own country, secondly, towards more prosperous African countries, and then finally, some will essentially follow the Eritrean model and try to make it to Europe.
Looking at Boko Haram and the Islamic State this year, do you see that relationship growing?
There are certain factors that inhibit its growth. The first is that the personnel that direct the Islamic State are really quite racist, and that inhibits the development of a closer relationship with an African movement like Boko Haram. Secondly, the focus of the Islamic State and Boko Haram is somewhat different, even if their theologies have much in common. The Islamic State is much more international. It seeks to destroy Western influence. Boko Haram's focus is overwhelmingly on the Nigerian state, the secular Nigerian state, which it seeks to destroy. So one tends to be more international than the other, and racism is a factor that inhibits cooperation between the two.
Do you think the power of either one of these two extremist groups will be reduced in 2016?
It will certainly be changed. For example, Boko Haram has moved away from controlling territory. It's, in a sense, reverted to an earlier pattern of attacks on soft targets, now particularly making use of female suicide bombers. ISIS, on the other hand, the Islamic State, on the other hand, would appear to be involved in efforts to carve out territory in Libya. So it seems to be becoming more territorial, just as Boko Haram is becoming less so.
Looking at another area in Africa, we're just coming off of a very big climate agreement with world leaders agreeing to reduce carbon emissions. So what do you see climate change doing to Africa this year?
Well, I think right now Africa is the greatest victim of climate change. There's desertification in the Sahel, and the drying up of wells, the reduction of pasturage, is contributing to general instability. People who traditionally have been herdsmen are being driven further south away from the Sahel, where they collide with traditional peasant farmers. Then there are direct economic consequences. For example, in Tanzania or in Zambia, a really serious drought has directly reduced the production of hydroelectricity. There's an ongoing drought as well in South Africa, which is a major producer of food for the African continent, and food production is dropping. That means food prices are going to rise. In a sense, what is happening in Africa ought to be a wake-up call for the rest of the international community. It's getting late.
So what then needs to be done right now?
as fast as possible the implementation of the agreements that were reached in Paris.
That was John Campbell, a Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He spoke with me from Washington.
Former Nigerian Defense Minister Bello Halira Mohammed appeared in court yesterday on charges he diverted $1.5 million in military funds. The funds had been allocated to buy equipment to fight Boko Haram militants. The Economic and Financial Crimes Commission says Mohammed appeared at the Abuja High Court in a wheelchair and was transferred to a hospital. He served as former President Goodluck Jonathan's defense minister from 2011 to 2012. He retains a senior position in Jonathan's opposition People's Democratic Party. His son, Bello Abba Mohammed, is also charged in the case. He's being held until a bail hearing tomorrow. Both men have denied the charges. In other news about Nigeria, International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde says the IMF wants to help trace money looted by government officials. President Buhari has pledged to stop fraud and corruption. He said he welcomes the IMF's support.
Officials from 24 African countries met in Cameroon last month and called for China to stop illegal fishing off the West African coast. In some areas, Chinese fishermen have pushed their local counterparts back to shore, depriving them of their jobs and livelihoods. Moki Edwin Kinziga has more from Yaoundé.
The 22-year-old former fisherman Biso Frederick now sells sandwiches in the Cameroonian town of Limbe on the West African coast. He says he and his colleagues were forced to abandon their jobs 3 years ago.
Au Cameroun en général, c'est un problème parce que ils nous envahissent, on n'a même plus accès.
He says they have lost their jobs to Chinese fishermen who have taken over all fishing areas. He says they are very worried. The government of Cameroon has allowed foreigners to do little jobs Cameroonians should have been doing. In a 2013 study, the environmental group Greenpeace reported that the number of Chinese fishing boats operating in African waters soared from 13 in 1985 to 462 in 2013. The report said there were 114 cases of illegal fishing over an 8-year period in the waters of Gambia, Guinea, Guinea-Bissau, Mauritania, Senegal, and Sierra Leone. It said the boats were operating without licenses or in prohibited areas. Amadi Diop, who is in charge of the Program for Aquaculture and Fishing at the New Economic Partnership for African Development, says such illegal activity is making African fish farmers poorer and destroying the environment.
Le poisson génère 24 milliards de dollars au niveau du continent.
He says the $24 billion fishing generates annually in the African continent is threatened by people who are taking far more fish from African waters than can be replaced by those remaining with the changing climate. He says the people who are suffering most are small-scale, low-technology and low-capital fish farmers who contribute 46% of the total revenue generated against industrial maritime fishing that contributes 33%. The head of the Regional Commission for Fishing in the Gulf of Guinea, Emil Esema, says the problem is getting worse because many African countries are not investing in their fishing sectors.
Ce secteur mal connu doit être connu parce que c'est déjà la volonté des chefs d'État.
He says the fishing sector is still neglected by many African states, and that is why African heads of state are being encouraged by the African Union to dedicate resources to boost fish farming and aquaculture. He says fishing can generate riches, solve food and nutritional crises, provide jobs for millions of unemployed youths and developed nations. The African Union convened a meeting in Yaounde last month to discuss the issue. Representatives called for African states to dedicate more resources to fishing and improve the lives of more than 90 million people they say are involved in small-scale fishing activities. They also asked China to abolish destructive fishing practices and stop taking advantage of African countries' fishing grounds. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaounde.
Researchers have found what may be a permanent cure for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, a disabling and eventually fatal genetic condition that affects boys. The new treatment essentially permanently repairs a mutated protein. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Duchenne muscular dystrophy, or DMD, is a relatively rare condition affecting approximately 1 in 5,000 boys worldwide. The disease causes the body to make a defective copy of a skeletal protein called dystrophin that holds the muscles together. The defective protein causes muscles to weaken and wither to the point that boys with Duchenne's end up in wheelchairs and usually die of heart or respiratory failure in their 20s and 30s. It's an X chromosome-linked disorder, meaning the defective gene that makes dystrophin is passed on to sons by their mothers. Girls have two copies of the X chromosome instead of one, so they're spared the disabling condition even if they inherit the genetic mutation from their mother. Using the so-called CRISPR gene editing technique, three independent groups of U.S. researchers literally cut out the defective portions of the dystrophin gene, so the remaining unaffected DNA was able to make healthy copies of the essential muscle protein. Rhonda Bassel-Duby is a molecular biologist at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. She was part of one of the teams that helped show that editing out the defective portions of the dystrophin gene stopped progression of the disease in mice.
We're able to cut in a very specific place, so it's directed cutting, and we're able to remove the mutant and hook it up in a way that you will be getting functional dystrophin being made.
The treatment only has to be performed one time for it to permanently halt progression. Investigators described in the journal Science how they used a harmless virus to carry the editing machinery into the muscles. Bassel-Duby cautions that much more research is needed before CRISPR becomes a reality for treating DMD.
You know, I just think this is really something that we hopefully can, you know, bring into clinics one day. That is my dream.
Eventually, Bassel-Duby thinks the gene editing technique will become available worldwide to treat all boys with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Islamic State militant attacks in Libya have set many oil storage tanks on fire. There are more sex abuse allegations against UN peacekeepers in Burundi, and it's estimated 20 million people are the victims of human trafficking. Coming up, we'll have music from Tanzania, and in our feature segment, the third part of our series examining sexual exploitation in Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with the annual African Football Awards ceremony.
Kim, joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Happy New Year, David.
Thank you very much, Sunny.
David, Nigeria's political capital, Abuja, getting ready to host the annual Confederation of African Football Awards ceremony on Thursday evening. How about a preview for our VOA football fans?
The final three are Yaya Toure, the Ivorian and Manchester City midfielder, is going for a record-extending fifth consecutive title. Previous to this, the best has been three in a row by Samuel Eto'o of Cameroon, and the great Ghanaian Abede Pele. So that's an indication of what Yaya Toure has done. He's won four in a row, and he is the favorite, Sonny, to make it five in a row. And it's always dangerous to say that a record will never be surpassed, but what Yaya Toure is doing is he's setting the bar now extremely high. Now, in last year's competition, the runner-up was Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, the Gabonese and Borussia Dortmund striker. He's a contender again, and my feeling is that he will once again be the runner-up. In favor of Aubameyang is his remarkable scoring rate in Europe. 27 goals in all competitions halfway through the 2015-2016 season for Borussia. That's goals in the Bundesliga, which is the German league. It's goals in the German FA Cup. And it's also goals in the Europa League, which is the European equivalent of the CAF Confederation Cup. And he has scored more goals than Ronaldo. He scored more goals than Messi, more goals than Neymar, more goals than Suarez. And you can't get much better than that. Now, that's the upside, Sonny. But the downside is that Gabon and Aubameyang himself had a pretty miserable 2015 Cup of Nations in Equatorial Guinea. The Gabonese started by beating Burkina Faso, but then they lost to Congo Brazzaville. They then lost to the hosts, Equatorial Guinea, and they were out after the first round. And Aubameyang did not really make much of an impact. So it could be close. The votes come from either the national coach or the technical director of each of the 54 members of CAF. So either the coach or the director can vote, but not both. We have also got the Africa-based Footballer of the Year. And here we've got two players from TP Mazembe, the reigning African champions. We've got the most colorful character in African football, goalkeeper Robert Kidiaba. He's now as close to 40 as makes no difference. He's got this wonderful ponytailed hairstyle. And most famous of all, he's got this bottom-bouncing celebration that he does every time Mazembe score a goal. His teammate, Mbwana Samata, he's a Tanzanian. He's a striker. He was the joint leading goal scorer in the Champions League with seven goals. And particularly in the closing stages of the 2015 Champions League, he was a key figure for Mazembe. And then the third candidate is Bagdad Bounedjab. Bagdad Bounedjab is an Algerian, but he plays for the Tunisian club Etoile Sahel. And they were the winners of the 2015 CAF Confederation Cup. And Bounedjab scored six of the goals and was very much like Samata. His goals played a vital role in the success of the club. Sticking my neck out, Sonny, I'm going to go with Samata. There are, of course, other awards as well, but the big two, undoubtedly, African Footballer of the Year, Yaya Toure, the favorite, and the Africa-based Footballer of the Year. And the general consensus seems to be that Mbwana Samata will become the first Tanzanian to win this award.
David, Rwanda getting ready to host the African Nations Championship, or CHAN, exclusively for players in African national leagues. How's that tournament shaping up?
Well, this is a unique competition in that it's restricted to home-based players. So, for example, if you're a Rwandan and you're playing in the Democratic Republic of Congo, you're ineligible. You must be playing in Rwanda. Similarly, as a Nigerian, you must be playing in the Nigerian leagues to qualify. And the reason for this, Sonny, is the president of CAF is Ahiatu. He felt some years ago that the local players were really playing in the shadow, so to speak. The Nigerian team was composed almost exclusively of overseas-based players, and that the local players were not really getting a chance to shine on the international stage. So I think this is a good initiative by CAF. It began in 2009 in the Ivory Coast with the first tournament. It was won by the Democratic Republic of Congo, a team that included Kidiaba. In 2011, it moved to Sudan, and it also went up from 8 teams to 16, which is where it stands now. The second tournament was won by Tunisia. They beat Angola 3-0 in the final. The third tournament was in 2014 in South Africa. And again, a real fairy tale finish here with Libya. Despite all their security problems post Muammar Gaddafi, they emerged victorious despite the fact that they only won one of their 6 games. The other 5 were drawn. They won the quarterfinal, semifinal, and the final against Ghana, all on penalty shootouts. So we've had a fair amount of drama, and I think Rwanda will be no different. The first thing, and a very important issue with Rwanda, is that the head of state, President Paul Kagame, is a very keen football fan, and he's right behind this tournament. Sonny, we often hear in Africa of this official and that official and this politician backing the tournament, and they're going to do this, that, and the other. But in actual fact, they do very little. But Kagame is an exception to that rule. He gets personally involved. He has said that he expects it to be a successful tournament, and I believe it will be. And Rwanda, to me, this is a stepping stone towards hosting the Cup of Nations itself. What the little Central African country has done already is host the African Under-17 Championship and the African Under-20 Championship. So they're doing it step by step. Now comes the CHAN. And if they are successful with that, I believe it's long overdue for the Cup of Nations to go to East Africa. The earliest that can do so is actually 2025. I know the Ethiopians are interested, but I think the Rwandans will officially, sooner or later, become interested. And if they can host this CHAN tournament well, successfully, get good crowds, and we have limited problems, I think they're going to be a strong candidate. On the football field, though, Rwanda are going to find it very tough. They're in Group A with Morocco, Ivory Coast, and Gabon, and that's a tough ask. Only the top 2 will qualify for the quarterfinals. Nigeria failed to qualify for the first 2 CHAN tournaments, and in the most recent one in South Africa, they finished 3rd. They beat Zimbabwe 1-0 in a playoff to get the bronze medals, and they will certainly be among the teams to watch. They're in Group C. They're up against Tunisia, who I think will probably be their strongest opposition. They're up against Niger and up against Guinea. So there's a distinct West African flavor to that group. If you then look, Sonny, at Group D, this one is difficult to call. You've got the 2 Zs, Zimbabwe and Zambia. You've got Uganda featuring the 18-year-old Farouk Mia, who I'm never tired of mentioning on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
A very promising player, one to watch. And then we've got Mali, and this is a tough one to pick. I'm going for Uganda and Mali, but I could easily be wrong with both my choices. Finally, we've got Group B. It's Angola, Cameroon, the Democratic Republic, and Ethiopia. And for me, the 2 teams that stand out here are Cameroon and DR Congo. DR Congo and Zimbabwe, incidentally, the only 2 countries that have qualified for all 4 editions of the CHAN, which carries a $750,000 first prize. And that's certainly money that's not to be sneezed at. So essentially, Sonny, with this CHAN, we're looking for plenty of goals and plenty of good football on the field. And off the field, we'll be watching with great interest to see if Rwanda can keep up their reputation for being very good organizers of CAF international competitions.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Johannesburg is also where the South African Open Golf Tournament tees off on Thursday. Reporter Mark Tompkins has this preview for us from Johannesburg.
The European Tour celebrates its 200th co-sanctioned event this week by joining forces with the Sunshine Tour for the BMW South African Open Championship at the Glendower Golf Club in Johannesburg. By a strange twist of fate, the milestone occurs on South African soil, where the first co-sanctioned event took place 21 years ago. Ernie Els triumphed in the 1995 South African PGA Championship, and he's one of eight former winners of this event taking part this week. Andy Sullivan returns to defend a title for the first time, having beaten Charles Schwartzel in a sudden-death playoff last year. Sullivan went on to win another two events in his breakthrough year at the Joburg Open and the Portugal Masters.
It's just nice to obviously come back to where you've won before, and just like I say, walking around yesterday, just reminiscing of shots hit on the back nine and in that playoff, you know, just fantastic feelings, you know. Sometimes, you know, you just can't write them things down, and it's been an incredible year, and it all started for me here, so... It's fantastic to get back and hopefully put up a good performance and a good fight this week.
Trevor Immelman is the last person to successfully defend this title after wins in 2003 and 2004. Also in the field this week, Retief Goosen, Henny Otto and Morten Oren Madsen, the 2014 winner. In a Ryder Cup year, several players will have their eyes on trying to improve their chances of taking part against the USA. But their immediate aim remains focused on adding their name to an impressive list of South African Open winners.
Thanks, Mark. Mark Tompkins reporting from Johannesburg. Tunisia has named its Sportsman and Sportswoman of the Year for 2015, as we hear now from Mark Ouma.
World Athletics Championship silver medalist Habiba Gribi is Tunisia's 2015 Sportswoman of the Year. Gribi was a clear winner in the poll conducted by the Tunisian media and private sector in Tunis. Gribi was runner-up in the women's 3,000-meter steeplechase at the World Championships in Beijing, China. She went on to set a new Africa women's 3,000-meter steeplechase record of 9 minutes and 5.35 seconds at the IAAF Diamond League in Brussels, Belgium. Staying in Tunis, judoka Faisal Jabala is Tunisia's 2015 Sportsman of the Year. Jabala earned the accolade for bagging a gold medal at the Africa Open Judo Championship staged in Tunis and a gold medal at the Grand Slam in Samsun, Turkey. Jabala also clinched a bronze medal at the Grand Slam in Budapest, Hungary.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma of our Daybreak Africa radio show, which you can hear Monday through Friday on The Voice of America. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahya's Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sunny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, the third part of our series examining sexual exploitation in Africa. And next, a former lost boy of Sudan becomes the first South Sudanese to be ordained as a deacon in the United States. But first, some music. Here is Steve R&B from Tanzania with Jumbo Jumbo.
Nasema jambo jambo mama, habari gani nzuri sana, ukiniacha nitaumia, mwenzio nitakuzimia. Nasema jambo jambo mama, habari gani nzuri sana, ukiniacha nitaumia, mwenzio nitakuzimia. Uzuri wako umenifanya niwe nawe kabisa, tabia ndiyo imenivuta niwe karibu moyoni, niwe na furaha baby, na furaha baby. Hakuna tanitenganisha, nitenganisha niwe nawe mbali ma, ni Mungu peke anaweza, anapenda sote tuwe na furaha baby, na furaha baby.
Steve R&B from Tanzania with Jumbo Jumbo.
While the sexual exploitation of children occurs in every country on Earth, an international NGO coalition is fighting to stop it. ECPAT estimates that worldwide at least 1.2 million children are currently victims of domestic or commercial sexual abuse. Today, in the third part of our series examining these crimes within Africa, we examine the sexual exploitation of children through the lens of the travel and tourism industries, which can sometimes enable it. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
Netsai Sibanda represents Fair Trade Tourism. It's a South African organization dedicated to promoting equity and justice within the multi-billion dollar tourist industry.
While tourism in general is not responsible for crimes against children, a lot of research and experience has shown within the sector that there is a clear connection between the tourism industry and the sexual exploitation of children in travel and tourism. We're not just looking at offenders coming from off the continent, but also within South Africa as well.
The exact number of exploited children in Southern Africa and the continent is hard to come by. But after 2 years of research, Fair Trade Tourism has developed a general profile of perpetrators. She says they mostly fall into two categories.
So we have people that travel with the intention of having sexual relations with someone under the age of 18. Or you find people that travel and come across the opportunity to have sexual relations with a child, and then they do it.
Theo Noten is a program director at ECPAT in the Netherlands, an international NGO dedicated to fighting the sexual exploitation of children in 83 countries. He says that many travelers mistakenly believe they're innocent of sexual exploitation when an encounter is initiated or encouraged by a young person, even when money is involved.
That is certainly an excuse that is being used often. Well, she offered herself to me. She smiled. She looked happy. So what's the problem? It belongs to their culture to be submissive or to be happy and be sexy.
And why is it wrong?
Well, is the girl doing this out of her own will? That's of course, the first question. Sex and commercial sex is often linked to other crimes, like drugs, also arms. So it's still in the criminal sphere. In many countries, it is not allowed by law, but it's condoned. So there's sort of this gray area, young people coming, let's say, from rural areas to a place where the money can be earned. Then the exploitation is around the corner.
In an attempt to gain hard data on the problem, the European Commission sponsored a study of child sexual exploitation in the Gambia, Kenya, Senegal, South Africa, and Madagascar. Nearly 500 child victims were interviewed, along with a similar number of professional stakeholders in government, NGOs, nonprofits, and the travel industry. Noten, who helped oversee the project for ECPAT, says Madagascar is especially troubled, not only with perpetrators from France, its former colonizer, but also India, China, and Russia.
There is a big problem, where it's also the local people, they play a role in this, so even families play a role in organizing the sexual exploitation of children. This is something horrible, absolutely. The role the communities play in such places is scary also, because if the communities don't care, how can we ever change this?
Still, Noten says he has reason for hope.
I've been myself in the Gambia, and there I have also seen that that you can make improvement if all the stakeholders, being the states, local people, but also the industry, make clear to the customers. And if they see it, then they will denounce you and will make sure that the police knows about it.
Getting Africa's tourism industry on board was given an enormous practical boost in 2006 when ECPAT delivered a proposed child protection code of conduct continent-wide for use by tourism trade groups and businesses who were committed to preventing their facilities from being staging grounds for abuse. Fair Trade Tourism, which administers the code in South Africa, works with airports, for example, to develop signage that communicates a zero-tolerance policy for the sexual exploitation of children. Hotel and resort hospitality staff can also get trained to prevent those crimes from occurring in-house. Netsai Sabanda says those trainings combine practical tips with common sense.
So we don't necessarily want every receptionist suspecting everybody checking into the hotel, picking up the phone and calling the police. But what we train them to do is to establish a policy and a clear procedure that they should follow in the event that they come across a suspected case.
As one example, reception staff can invoke the code's recommendation that all children and all adults with children be required to present identification. Seeing the ID can tell the receptionist the age of the child and can lead to other questions, which in turn can lead to a call to local child protective services or the police. But ECPAT research and reports indicate that more industry training must be done to combat the sexual exploitation of children. These strategies include anti-poverty efforts to discourage young people from choosing sex as the only means to support themselves, the creation of rigorous national action plans and task forces, and the insistence on cooperation and accountability between the tourism industry, policymakers, NGOs, community leaders, and law enforcement. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Former lost boy of Sudan celebrated a milestone in December. Gabriel Garang Atam became the first South Sudanese to be ordained as a deacon in the Episcopal Diocese of Utah in the Western United States. He says the accomplishment was the accumulation of years of hard work and determination. Ayan Bior has more.
36-year-old Deacon Atem says he invited family and friends from all over the United States to attend his ordination ceremony earlier this month at St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Salt Lake City, Utah. He calls it one of the proudest moments of his life. Atem fled the conflict in southern Sudan in 1987 and ended up in Kakuma refugee camp. He says Kakuma is where a love for the church began to grow deep inside him.
In the refugee camps, I was a teacher, training people with the catechism, training people with choirs, teaching people about life and many things that human beings need in life. Not because I'm perfect, but I have been doing that because it is my call to be able to work in the ministry.
That calling stayed with him throughout the years. When Atem immigrated to the United States in 2001, along with 20,000 other lost boys, he said it was important for him to immediately find a church that he could regularly attend. He landed in the East Coast city of Richmond, Virginia, where he gave Bible lessons to the South Sudanese community at a local church. By 2004, Atem says he realized he would be better positioned to pursue a bachelor's degree in theology if he moved to Salt Lake City, Utah. So he packed up his belongings and went west. In Salt Lake City, he found a home church at St. Mark's Episcopal Church.
I continued to do the work in my diocese, the Diocese of Utah. They were really giving me a good chance to go to school, and they were really being able to support us as a community of faith. Like some of us who have been going to school, they were actually getting some assistance on buying books for their studies.
St. Mark's also provided the South Sudanese community with clothes, including much-needed winter coats for the below-freezing temperatures of Utah. Atem says the church also donated food to a South Sudanese community and provided career advice to anyone that was willing to receive it. Atem says he owes his success to the help he received from the people in the Episcopal Diocese. He says it is only fitting that he has been ordained in the Diocese of Utah, where he is anxious to give back to a church that has given him so much. Atem says he's well aware of the controversy surrounding the Episcopal Church's change in attitude toward homosexuals and gay marriage over the past decade. In 2003, the church consecrated its first openly gay bishop. And in 2012, a temporary sacrament of the blessing for same-gender relationships was approved, and discrimination against transgender persons in the ordination process was officially prohibited. This disturbed many South Sudanese Episcopalians. But Atem says it is important to remember that people should not judge others. He says it is the church's job to love and accept all people. He also points out that what is a cultural norm in one country could be against a law in another. For example, he says unlike here in the U.S., South Sudanese men are allowed to have multiple wives back home.
So we should not intend to be able to say yes. Well, whatever has been done in this country has to be done in South Sudan. As you know, we have so many different cultures, different lives in our country, whereby people can marry, tend to 8, 9 wives. So we never rejecting that. In this country, they believe on right of individuals. It will not affect their life as a South Sudanese or as an African in general. They haven't come to our life and say, do not do this as a South Sudanese. Do not believe in this as a South Sudanese. No, we are the same brothers and sisters. We don't judge one another. Only God will judge for us. So simply, if you don't believe in it, no one imposes it for you.
In a few months, Atim will be qualified to be ordained as a priest in the Diocese of Utah. He says that has always been his dream. He also plans to earn a master's degree in theology. The Diocese of Utah does not require deacons or priests to have a master's degree in theology. But Atim says he wants to achieve that goal in order to maximize his growth as a South Sudanese as well as a priest. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Cornelius, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States on December 19th expressed disappointment in the process followed by the government of Rwanda to call a referendum on short notice to amend the Rwandan constitution. Among the amendments considered were those introducing exceptions to presidential term limits. In a statement released December 19th, National Security Council spokesperson Ned Price said, "While we commend the people of Rwanda for peacefully exercising their civic rights, we regret that the arrangements for the referendum failed to provide sufficient time and opportunity for political debate on the merits of the proposed provisions." The United States continues to be concerned by long-standing restrictions on peaceful assembly, association, and free expression in Rwanda. The U.S. urges the government of Rwanda to enable the full and unfettered exercise of these fundamental freedoms as the country moves toward local elections in 2016, presidential elections in 2017, and parliamentary elections in 2018. The peaceful transfer of power from one leader to another is the hallmark of stable, prosperous democracies. President Kagame, who in many ways has strengthened and developed Rwanda, now has an historic opportunity to enshrine his legacy by honoring his commitments to respect the term limits set when he entered office. By doing so, President Kagame would help to more firmly establish a credible foundation for long-term democracy in Rwanda, reinforce the substantial progress that has been achieved towards sustained peace and prosperity for all Rwandans, and set a laudable example not only for Rwanda, but for the region and the world. As U.S. President Obama has stated, great leaders throughout history forged a lasting legacy not only because of what they did in office, but because they were willing to leave office and transfer power peacefully. The United States remains committed to supporting the people of Rwanda in their effort to ensure a strong, stable, democratic, and prosperous future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
African Music Mix.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.